This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So MPLA is ahead according to the National Electoral Commission with 52.08%.
That was VOA's Myra Fernandez reporting from Luanda on the preliminary results of Angola's election. Details coming up. Also, Cameroon and Nigeria have reopened their shared borders after declaring the area free of Boko Haram militants. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. French President Emmanuel Macron's three-day trip to Algeria will try to smooth out rocky relations between the two countries and allow him to develop his relationship with young Algerians. However, the North African country's leaders may prove hard to win over as Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune wants solid investment commitments and for Macron to atone for comments he made last year about Algeria's history and its ruling elite. William Lawrence, professor of political science and international relations at the American University in Washington, discussed the visit and its objective with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The big issues for France are Ukraine and the price of gas. And the Ukrainian conflict has pitted France to some degree against many of its African partners, with Algeria at the front of the list, taking its neutral stance and sort of leading the African continent in that regard. And the French see that neutral position is highly problematic, including the fact that tens of thousands of Africans, including Algerians, got stuck in Ukraine and faced racism at the Polish border getting out. And there were many other negative effects of the Ukraine conflict, including inflation and food insecurity issues that hit Africa quite hard, and yet they maintain this neutral stance, which France found problematic since, in some respects, the future of Europe's at stake in Ukraine. The other thing is the gas price, but there's a long history here of Algerian and French disputes over whether the French are being charged too little or the right amount or too much for Algerian gas. That's sort of a never-ending discussion over the last 40 years, but it is true that France and Europe are trying to wean themselves of Russian gas and oil, and Algeria, along with Libya, Nigeria, and then some other countries, can play a really important role in helping Europe get through the winter without as much Russian gas and oil. In terms of the Algerian interests, I don't think the French are going to go far enough, but what's important is the gesture. So French presidents before Macron and Macron in 2017 and last year made a number of non-apologies and gaffes in talking about the Franco-Algerian history, the history of colonialism and the war, and much more can be done here. I don't think, for domestic political reasons, Macron is going to go for a full apology or full reparations like he needs to, but instead, if he can at least make gestures in the right direction, he can signal that France is going to try in the future to get the history right and then get reparations in order that the Algerians feel they are due, including greater investment. France, most of the investment is public and not private, so Macron does have the power to get French companies to invest in the Algerian context. The biggest problem is that the Algerian domestic law is very unfriendly to foreign investment. So if Algerians want the investment, they're going to have to make adjustments to their investment law and their handling of foreign companies. And if Macron can get Algeria to move in the direction of some reforms, that would help everybody, starting with Algerians.
As you indicated, France's interest in the Algerian gas market can be explained by the European Union's decreasing reliance on Russian imports in the wake of the Ukrainian war. However, the Elysee was quick to point out that gas was not the priority of this friendship visit. Do you see gas still as a major objective of Macron's visit?
Absolutely. Algeria really wants to make good on its existing gas contracts, whether with Spain, whether with Italy, with whom they've signed major new agreements, and with France, with whom they have had this prickly relationship, but it's been getting better lately. Many people have pointed out that this is not a state visit, it's an official visit, but, you know, following the withdrawal of ambassadors and following French-established global diplomatic practice, place, it's kind of normal for official visits to precede state visits and greater levels of cooperation. But there's no question here that by including the French Engie CEO on the plane, that there will be discussions around gas, if not in the public spot, but on the official meetings going on in Algerian ministries and palaces, you know, those will include an energy conversation. And it's vital for Europe, and it's vital for Algeria's reputation. And Algeria is making a lot of money in this context because of the higher energy prices.
Algerian state media has published stories critical of France in the run-up of Macron's visit, and conservative politicians have voiced annoyance at Macron's decision to bring the Bishop of Algiers and France's chief rabbi to visit a colonial-era cemetery for non-Muslims as a move aimed to encouraging Algeria to normalize ties with Israel. What do you make of that?
Algerians will stay very pro-Palestinian and will not normalize with Israel. France knows this, and the Algerian press is just restating that. That's not going to change anytime soon. What can change, France needs to get better at recognizing its own multiculturalism and multi-religiosity. Algeria can do the same. That's all to the positive. There's not going to be any discussions of normalization anytime soon in Algeria.
That was William Lawrence, professor at the American University in Washington. He was speaking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. The World Food Program, WFP, is calling for greater financial support for Sahrawi refugees living in five camps in southwestern Algeria. The agency says global health emergencies and a deteriorating situation are putting at risk access to food, water, health, nutrition, and educational services for over 90,000 people. The WFP notes that funds needed for food assistance alone have doubled from nearly $20 million before the COVID pandemic to almost $40 million today. Monthly rations have been reduced 75% to 5 kilograms per person, less than half of the recommended daily intake of calories. Health officials blame the deteriorating situation in part on rising food and fuel prices from the war in Ukraine, as well as a desert environment that constrains agriculture and livestock production. Health ministers attending the World Health Organization's 72nd Regional Committee for Africa in Lomé, Togo, have approved an 80-year strategy aimed at curbing disease and responding quickly to health emergencies. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 400 people participated from 47 countries, including about 30 health ministers who attended the top annual health gathering in person, while others joined online. After a week of discussions about some of Africa's most pressing health issues, countries adopted a new strategy for creating more resilient public health systems for responding to infectious and chronic diseases such as diabetes. The World Health Organization says early diagnosis and care could save the lives of many of the millions who die from the diseases. The plan also commits countries to reach critical targets by 2030 to strengthen their ability to prepare, detect, and respond to health emergencies. The WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says the ministers also have launched a new campaign to curb sickle cell disease. She notes it is one of the most common yet least recognized illnesses in the region. However, like childhood tuberculosis, she says it has been pushed to the sidelines for far too long.
As we've seen with COVID-19, the impact of sickle cell disease extends well beyond health, posing significant economic and social costs for patients and their families. We can't afford to continue ignoring the threat, so greater investments and stronger collaboration and partnerships need to be prioritized. Childhood TB also doesn't typically receive much attention, even though one in every three TB cases among children globally occurs in our region.
She says both require timely diagnosis and treatment, as do other diseases such as monkeypox that go largely ignored until they make headlines elsewhere. Currently, she says 406 cases and 7 deaths have been confirmed across 11 African countries. While these are far fewer cases compared to other geographic regions, she says there is a need to increase the response. She notes there is a shortage of monkeypox vaccine, and whatever is available is being used in wealthier countries where the epidemic is raging. She says no monkeypox vaccines or antivirals are available in African countries.
We are making a plea that the situation that African countries have experienced with COVID-19 vaccines should not be repeated. And we are still hopeful that with the advocacy being carried out and the discussions with countries that are helping to produce the vaccines, that we may obtain vaccine supplies for African countries. This is not the case up to today.
Moeti says there is better news regarding COVID-19 coverage. She notes vaccination rates are going up among health workers, older people, and those at risk of severe illness, hospitalization, and death. While there is still much to be done, Moeti says she believes it is possible for African countries to catch up with the rest of the world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Governors from Cameroon and Nigeria plan to reopen markets and rebuild schools along their shared border after declaring the area free of Boko Haram militants. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Babagana Umara Zulum, governor of Nigeria's Borno State, says President Muhammadu Buhari instructed governors of border states affected by Boko Haram to work with neighboring countries to improve living conditions. He says governors from Cameroon and Nigeria will reopen border markets and rebuild schools in towns and villages where Boko Haram has been defeated.
We are doing everything possible to ensure that the banking market is re-established. The bringing of cattle from the Republic of Chad to Cameroon to Nigeria has stopped. My humble salute and the governor will go and reopen the cattle road from Cameroon. It will improve the economy of Nigeria and improve the economy of Cameroon. In September, we shall be going to Chad and Niger to see how we can improve on our bilateral relationship.
Babagana spoke by a messaging app from Maiduguri, capital of Nigeria's Borno State, on Thursday, after meeting a delegation led by Mijiyawa Bakari, governor of Cameroon's far north region. He said the Gamborungalab cattle market, which is the largest in northeast Nigeria, was shut down in May 2014 after Boko Haram fighters massacred 300 civilians and abducted 200 people. The market is near Nigeria's border with Cameroon. Bakari, who is also chairman of the Lake Chad Basin Governors Forum, says he was asked by Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, to visit border localities where Boko Haram has been eliminated.
Le chef d'État avait dépêché le ministre des Travaux publics.
Bakari says less than a month ago, President Biya dispatched his Minister of Public Works to make sure that border roads in areas where Boko Haram has been defeated are repaired to boost cross-border trade. He says the Bankie market is among several dozen near the Cameroon-Nigeria border that want to collectively reopen. Bakari said the border markets and schools that were destroyed by Boko Haram will be reopened before December. He said he had fruitful meetings this week in Nigeria with the governor of Yobe and Borno states. Both states say Boko Haram attacks have been greatly reduced and people can resume their activities. Cameroon says peace has also returned to a majority of its northern border with Nigeria. In June, the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission said its troops from Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad killed more than 800 jihadists in about 2 months of fighting on the Cameroon-Nigeria border. The task force was constituted in 2015 to fight Boko Haram and its rival, the Islamic State in West Africa province, ISWAP. Cameroon and Nigeria say there is an increase in the number of Boko Haram militants surrendering at disarmament centers since May of 2021, when Abubakar Shekau, leader of the Islamist group, was declared killed. Last week, President Buhari visited Borno State, the former epicenter of Nigeria's Islamist insurgency, and formally opened 500 units of newly built resettlement houses for people internally displaced by the 13-year Boko Haram conflict. The United Nations says more than 37,000 people have been killed and about 2.8 million people displaced by the Boko Haram uprising that began in 2009. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
A day after Election Day, votes are being tallied in Angola's national election. I talked to my colleague, Mayra Fernandes, from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service, who is in the Angolan capital, about the preliminary results and what's next in the process.
Hello, thank you again for having me. Yesterday, August 24th, was Election Day in Angola, general elections, and The polls, they closed at the time that they were supposed to. It was at 5 p.m. And right there, the vote started being counted. It was a long night for the polling station's officials. Everything went well. There were no official complaints, even though there were little incidents here and there that people shared via social media, that civil society movements were denouncing, such as during the vote count. Each polling station has to produce a document. It's a final document that reports on how many people voted there, how many votes were valid, you know, all the details about the voting during the day. And we witnessed in some of polling stations that we went to, some officials didn't want to share that information. According to the law, the electoral law, after you conclude the count, you need to release it and make it public at the door of the polling station or at the wall so people can go and check on it. Yesterday, there was the ruckus during the count or after the count at some polling stations. Here in Luanda, at least, some of these officials didn't want to release those results, okay. Reports.
That's understandable. But overall, Mayra, what you're saying is it was a very peaceful election day and people were motivated and they were really into the whole idea of democratic voting.
Exactly. The turnout seemed to be very good. It was, in general, it was peaceful, yes. There was no major incidents. I've talked to Mr. Joaquim Chissano, former president of Mozambique. He's an international observer, and he had just been at the Kenya elections, and he did say that so far everything seemed to be peaceful, no major incidents, and that they were satisfied with the way the process was going.
So, Mayra, now we come to today. Votes are being tallied in Angola's national elections, and there are reports of parliamentary elections have been counted. Provisional results have been made public. So let's talk a little about that.
Yes. So today we have 86.41% of the votes counted. So MPLA is ahead according to the National Electoral Commission with 52.08%. Right after comes UNITA with 42.98%. And then all the other parties, the other six parties that are running on 1%, 0 point something, so nothing very relevant. One interesting point to make here is that the votes per province, they show that UNITA won in Luanda, which is new. It's historic if at the end those numbers don't change. This is a new thing because UNITA never won in Luanda in the previous elections.
It's probably the youth vote is factoring in here.
That's what the analysts on the national TV are actually saying, that the major population is in the province of Luanda, and it's mainly very, very young.
That was Mayra Fernandez from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. She talked to me from Angola's capital, Luanda. Health officials in the Eastern DRC are struggling with a medical response after the confirmation of a new Ebola outbreak in the Beni region of North Kivu province. Hand-washing facilities, which are useful in the fight against Ebola, are still not visible in high-traffic areas such as markets and churches. Authorities are calling for vigilance and promise that measures will be put in place soon to contain the outbreak. Journalist Zanem Neti Zaidi reports from Goma.
For more than 3 days, the people of Beni have been living as is everything were normal in their town, once again hit by Ebola. No hand-washing facilities have been set up at the entrance and exit of the town, nor in busy places such as churches, markets, schools, and parking lots. Residents are therefore calling on the authorities to put in place a rapid response to stop the new epidemic. A resident of Beni town, Kakule Kenzire, says it was a disappointment to learn that the disease is reappearing in the region, an area that has once before been badly affected. He regrets not seeing a big mobilization of the authorities to eradicate the disease. Vaccination activities are slow to start in the area affected by the Ebola resurgence, with the choice of medication also under discussion. Dr. Michel Tosalisana is the chief medical officer of the Beni Health Zone. He says that health workers are still waiting for guidance from the top. He says they are using different types of vaccines depending on the appropriate strategy, either Johnson & Johnson or Ervebo, which was approved and used during the last outbreak in the Beni Health Zone. The mayor of Beni, Narcisse Muteba Kashale, is calling on residents to collaborate with medical teams. He also believes that the experience gained in the fight against past epidemics must be capitalized on so that this Ebola resurgence is short-lived. He says that he invites the population to respect hygiene measures, to alert health professionals of any suspicious case, to refer patients to the appropriate care facilities, to receive health teams, to facilitate their work, and to accept dignified and safe burials. The first Ebola case is a 46-year-old woman. She was admitted to the Beni General Referral Hospital for treatment on July 23rd before dying on August 15th, 2022, according to the result of sample analysis conducted by the National Institute for Biomedical Research. To date, she is the only case that has been identified, in addition to 179 of her contacts already identified by health teams. I'm Zanem Neti Zaidi for VOA News.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.